We had to have those hard conversations of what happens if I don't wake up from the surgery, being told that I have 2 years left to live. And if I hadn't pursued this, I would have regretted it.
Hey everyone, welcome to Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. I'm your host, Adam Leventer. $4,000, that's it. That is all my next guest, Laura Thompson, and her co-founder, Connie Lowe, had when they launched Three Ships Beauty, an all-natural, radically transparent skincare company backed by scientifically proven formulas.
The term natural actually isn't regulated, so brands will claim this without anything to back it up. At Three Ships, our definition is that everything is derived from plants or minerals. It needs to have its source in nature.
Today, they've cracked the code that more than 95% of founders never solve, crossing that $1 million annual revenue mark.
Even when we were on Dragon's Den, we were still hand-making product, and we were still shipping everything out of her parents' basement.
The success didn't come overnight. They survived a complete rebrand.
We got a cease and desist letter from them saying like, oh, you're infringing on our trademarks. And, well, that's fine. We're already going to be changing our name.
Worked their way up from a local weekend market to Whole Foods.
Halfway through the conversation, she flipped her name badge around and it was a national buyer for Whole Foods.
And they've also just raised $3.5 million in funding.
We would be on calls with these investors from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and we just had meetings like scheduled back to back to back.
Laura, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I think an important question for a lot of founders is when does it make sense to go all in full time on something? Because, you know, they're working full time, they have a side hustle that's mm-hmm. generating some traction, but not enough income to quit their full time job. So when does it make sense? And when did you jump in to Three Ships full time?
I'm really glad that you asked this question because it's something I think a lot of founders get wrong because they either quit and go full time too late or way too early. And I think it's something that Connie and I actually did a really good job of. So it's a very personal question. But for us, we, one, wanted to make sure that we had enough personally saved that we wouldn't need to pull a salary for at least 6 months. When you're first getting a business launch, it's like a young child. It needs all of the nutrition, all of the energy, which is basically money, for it to grow and keep thriving. And it can become incredibly stressful as a founder if you're like, I don't know how I'm going to pay my bills next month if I don't take money from the business. It just adds an extra level of desperation and it causes you to make decisions you probably wouldn't make otherwise. So have a huge safety net. That 6 months ended up being 12 months before we paid ourselves anything. And then I think for the year following that, Connie and I were only paying ourselves like $2,000 a month. Like we were basically making less than minimum wage, but it was something. And then, so that was one thing of like personal savings. The second thing is, do you know what you're actually going to be doing once you go full time? I think a lot of founders quit too early and then they quit and they're like, okay, great. Yeah, I'm a full-time founder. I can full-time work on my business. And then they're like, wait, what now? Like, okay, I've finished my work in basically 2 hours, 3 hours, because you just don't have enough traction to actually know what you're going to spend your time doing. So wait until a point that you're like, I cannot manage these two things. I'm having to use all of my vacation time at my 9 to 5 to go and do work things. I'm having to like sneak aside into conference rooms to take business calls. Like you'll feel when that moment starts to happen, that traction starts to build without you just constantly pushing and there's a growing to-do list. That's probably a good indication that you have enough momentum to go full-time with the company. So those were the two things that we made sure that we had in place.
When you got started, did you have a full-time job?
I did. Uh-huh. Yeah, I was working full-time in tech sales, if you can believe it. Mm. I went to school for chemical engineering. And during that time, I had run two businesses while I was in school, which is probably ill-advised with my course load, to be honest. One of them was an exterior house painting business. And through that process, I fell in love with what entrepreneurship is. I loved that every day was different. I loved the risks, the unknowns. I loved working with customers. I learned that I did not like painting. I did not like being messy every day. I didn't like being in a services-based industry. And I also didn't like being a solo founder. I wanted to have a co-founder. But mm-hmm. I was working a 9 to 5 in tech sales at the time that we started Three Ships.
So why beauty? How did the transition from painting to beauty happen?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I really wanted to focus on a product-based business. And so I started looking at different products that I was using every day and the ones that had the greatest pain points for me. And beauty really stood out. The industry has so many problems with it. I don't know how familiar you are with natural skincare. The term natural actually isn't regulated. So brands will claim this without anything to back it up. And that frustrated me to my core. I felt like I was being lied to by these big multinational companies. And then on the flip side, once you did find a product that was actually natural, oftentimes it didn't deliver results. It had really gross, goopy textures, smelt like just lavender was slathered all over your face, or it was really, really expensive, like $200 for one cream, which I could not afford as a student. And many women can never afford in their lives. And so I saw an opportunity for products that were truly natural and actually meant something to us to have a standard that we live and die by, to also have products that are more affordable and actually deliver results for people. And then so that's what prompted 3Ships and caused us to launch this line.
When you say the term natural is not regulated, or there's no sort of like clear definition around the term, as a consumer, what should we understand natural to be then?
You'll have to do a lot of your own research, unfortunately, because every brand and every retailer sets their own definition of what natural is. Mm. At 3Ships, our definition is that everything is derived from plants or minerals. It can go through other processes afterwards to refine, to extract the actual skincare ingredient out of that plant or mineral, but it needs to have its source in nature. So it requires a lot of digging and research into those standards. You can rely on third-party certifications, like EWG is one of the great ones that will do their own vetting and research for you so that you can have greater confidence when you're shopping, but it's unfortunately a little bit of the Wild West right now.
So when you get started, do you have savings for this beauty brand that you're about to launch? How much capital did you need or did you have?
I had $2,000. I had $500 I was given as a graduation gift from my grandparents and $1,500 that I won during a graduation like award for what was effectively most improved student. So the student that saw the best improvement between first year and fourth year. And so that was the $2,000 I used to start the business. And then I met my co-founder, Connie. And when I met her, I was like, okay, well, we're going to be 50 partners in this. I've already put in $2,000. So you need to match that with your $2,000. And that's how we ended up starting the business with $4,000. It was not really based off of anything of like, this is how much it's going to take to launch. It was just, that's all we had.
I heard there was like quite a tight timeline between the time you and Connie met.
Yeah.
And the time you both decide to start this business.
Really tight timeline. So we're very close now. We're best friends now. People assume that we were best friends when we started the business. She was a stranger to me. I met her in November 2019. She was connected to me through a mutual friend, someone that was one of my good friends from university, knew her from middle school. And he was like, oh, Laura, you're thinking of starting this skincare line. Meet my friend Connie. She's like a beauty junkie from when we went to middle school together. She would go home and put like cucumbers on her face and like lie down on the couch kind of girl. And so I met up with her to just do some market research. I brought my little minimum viable product I'd made in my own kitchen in my small basement unit in Liberty Village, and started talking to her about this idea that I had. And what turned out, it was supposed to just be a 45-minute initial dinner, turned into like a 2.5-hour founder first date, essentially, that we dug really, really deep into what each of our core values were, our upbringing. We talked about our Myers-Briggs personality types because we're nerds like that. And then just got a sense of what each of us wanted out of our lives. And through that conversation, she kept dropping hints of, oh, I've always wanted to be a founder and to start my own business, but I just don't have any ideas. Whereas I knew that I wanted a co-founder in this and just felt this instant connection and trust with her. We're also polar opposite personality types. I'm an introvert. She's an extrovert. I'm a numbers person. She's a people person. She loves her systems, but doesn't like risk. I appreciate systems, but love taking risks. And so we balance each other out really, really well. And we were also interested in polar opposite ends of the business. And so at the end of that founder first date, I asked her, I was like, do you want to be my co-founder? This is a serious commitment. You'll have to really think about it. You'll have to invest some money. But she instantly said yes. And I think we met up again 2 days later to start working together. The first thing we did, which is so funny looking back on this now, is we designed business cards. And that was the first thing that we decided to do together. I think we spent an hour and a half and they're still like so ugly what we ended up with, but we were so proud of them. And then we ended up launching the business just 4 months later in March of 2017, initially under a different brand name. Mm-hmm. And it was more us hand-making products out of her condo kitchen and shipping out of my place.
Yeah. Initially under a different brand name. You did mention earlier that there was a rebrand at some point to 3Ships. What was the genesis of that?
Yeah. So it was a lot of like when we first got started, we didn't have any money to do any market research. So it was a lot of just based off of, well, we think that this is who the consumer is. We got that totally wrong. We thought that our consumer would be really, really young, ended up being a lot older than what we expected. And so our branding, which was really like cheeky, lots of pink and florals, didn't really resonate with the more mature audience that we ended up appealing to. We also were not able to get the trademark for original name. The original name was called New Body. We did not know that there's this like multinational, huge mega corporation called New Skin. And actually, I think it was like a month after we decided that we were going to go through the rebranding because we were not able to get the trademark and we didn't feel like going and fighting it out. We got a cease and desist letter from them saying like, oh, you're infringing on our trademarks. And so we were like, well, that's fine. We're already going to be changing our name. We're relatively small and unknown.
Nothing like a CND letter to prompt a rebrand,
right?
To prompt
a rebrand, exactly, exactly.
So it sounds like all good things with you and Connie now. Fast forward, you know, 8 years, the business has done incredibly well. You've got an $8.5 million run rate.
Yeah, last year.
Congrats on that.
This year it's doubled, which is wild.
It's unbelievable. But let's rewind back to the first inning of this. When you start out, how long did it take for you guys to get to, say, $1 million? In top line revenue?
It took 3 or 4 years, I believe. Our first year in 2017, we did $40,000. We were actually profitable that year, which we wouldn't be profitable again for another 4 or 5 years. The next year, I think we did a little over 100. Then we did 500,000. And then that fourth year, I think, is when we did over $1 million. So it was definitely a slow burn. And the rebrand to Three Ships was hugely beneficial for us. I think that that really allowed us to accelerate our growth. It was a big breakthrough, allowed us to raise money off of it. We were able to land Dragon's Den, able to land major retailers. Things just really started to gain more momentum once we found the right product market fit with our branding.
You mentioned a few of those milestones. One being Dragon's Den, two being retail.
Yeah.
When you look back, do you think there was sort of a key turning point that allowed you to scale to that $1 million mark?
To the $1 million mark, a lot of it was just hustle and grit to get to that point. I think that without the rebrand to Three Ships, I'm not sure that we would have been able to get there with the old brand without a lot more just like kind of like luck and determination. So I'd say a key turning point was transitioning to the new brand Three Ships. Dragon's Den was also huge for us within the Canadian market. Gave us so much more exposure, a lot more credibility. We were able to start running ads more effectively because we could use some of like the fact that we are on Dragon's Den. It carries a lot of cachet within Canada. So those I'd say were some of the breakthrough moments. But I mean, it's a lot of grit and hustle. Like even when we were on Dragon's Den, we were still hand making product. Connie and I, we had no other employees really in the business. We had one kind of like contractor, part-timer that was working for us at the time. And we were still shipping everything out of her parents' basement. So it was not as glamorous as I think a lot of people imagine that it is to have a $1 million company. It's oftentimes very, very gritty. And the founders are still like heavily involved in actually creating the product.
How did you think about marketing and customer acquisition in those early days? Did you have the capital to spend platforms like Meta or otherwise to drive traffic to the Three Ships website?
We had no capital. We actually tried to set up Facebook ads once. And I think Connie and I had no idea what we were doing. Like we're not growth gurus at all. And so we had tried to set up an ad campaign. It ended up spending $0 because I think we were just too narrow with what we were asking it to find. Like we were asking it to find a unicorn customer and it was like, I can't find this. So the good news is that we didn't waste any money because it didn't spend. But the main source of acquisition in those early, early days for us was going to farmers markets, in-person craft shows, setting up a booth where we would basically pay $100, $120 for the space for the full day. We'd be standing there selling product, but we could do $1,500 to $2,000 in 8 hours at those markets. And then we started to build up more of a local following and awareness for the people that went to those things. So a lot of those customers are still with us now. It was a great way for us to gain our first customers because we were able to interact with them in person. We could see how they were engaging with the product. We were like, okay, yeah, after every single person applies this to their hand, they're smelling their hand instantly. So clearly scent is a really important thing. Either having no scent or having a scent that's really neutral or that most people will like. We also learned that there were some ingredients that were really polarizing. Lavender is one of them. Some people love lavender. Some people like absolutely hate it. Same with coconut. Some people love coconut scents or coconut ingredients.
Interesting.
Other people just really avoid them with everything that they can. And so those early stages allowed us to learn so much about the consumer and how they consume skincare and how we could improve our product and our packaging. And it was actually a really smart way in hindsight, I think, to launch a product at these in-person events because you can see people's reactions. And it allowed us to be really nimble and quickly pivot, change our product packaging, change the formulas.
Do you think that if you were to start this again today, that you would approach it the same way in terms of the in-person grassroots approach to marketing?
I would probably keep doing that just because it's such a great way to get revenue in the door when you're mm-hmm. first getting started. I would have leaned more into social earlier, I would say. It's so much bigger now, social media, of course, with the rise of TikTok and Instagram Reels. These algorithms have just gotten so good at getting us hooked into things. So I would have accepted a lot earlier that part of your job as a founder, unfortunately, is to be a content creator. And that's something that's been somewhat of a difficult transition for Connie and I, because I think many founders, when they first get started, that's not really what they envisioned. But it's an important aspect of building a community and having a relationship with your customers and being able to stand out online. So that would have been something that we would have done differently if we were to launch that same brand in like today's day and age, is getting on TikTok and creating reels and doing all the content stuff a lot earlier.
Just want to circle back to something you mentioned very early on, this idea of wanting a product company, not a service. When you thought about the actual category that you wanted to develop, why beauty given the competition that is in this space right now? And I would imagine like back in 2017, 2018, same thing, right? There's a ton of beauty brands, many of whom were online. Did you think about that at all? Was that just an afterthought and you just had it in your head that this is the direction we're going and that's it?
Yeah, it was more of an afterthought. It was something that people constantly asked us, especially when you're first getting started. Something that you're going to experience is a lot of family members and friends are going to poke holes in your idea. Mm. And I think I would say to other entrepreneurs, don't let this dissuade you, because it's their way of showing you love. They don't want to see you fail. They don't want to see you get hurt. And so they're going to find every single reason that your business isn't going to work and it's not going to succeed. And that was probably the most common thing that people said is, oh, skincare is so competitive. Like, why don't you pick something else? And it was really just like, yeah, it is competitive, but how many women have just one skincare product? Like, they don't. They use multiple products. They enjoy exploring and trying new things. Trends change. We saw such a gap in the market for natural products that were actually natural and actually worked. Like, there wasn't anything within that category. And so even though it was competitive, we were so passionate about it that I don't think that that really occurred to us of being like, oh yeah, there's so many products, we're not going to be able to carve out a space for ourselves. It just didn't cross our minds.
Okay. So as I understand it, Whole Foods is the first big retailer that you partner with. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that's correct. We had a lot of retailers come on at around the same time post Dragon's Den. But if I recall, I think they were the first like large retailer that we brought
on.
Are
they coming to you because of Dragon's Den? Or are you approaching them and saying, hey, we were on Dragon's Den. Here's the footage. This is legitimate. How did this all work?
I think we met them before Dragon's Den. So I'm pretty sure that I think it might have been January of 2020 or maybe even sometime in 2019 before we had, and this was with the old brand, we were at a trade show, I believe in LA or New York, and a bunch of buyers go to these trade shows to discover new brands. And my co-founder, Connie, was talking to this woman that came up to the booth. Her name tag was flipped around so that she didn't know who she was. She thought that she was maybe just a consumer or like a small shop, because that was most of the buyers that were walking around were really small mom and pop type stores. And then halfway through the conversation of Connie telling her about what we were doing, she flipped her name badge around and it was a national buyer for Whole Foods. Mm. And so that's when we first met that buyer. Connie is an incredible relationship builder. And so she kept that lead really, really warm until we were at a point that we felt that we were really ready for that. So it was, again, a gradual process. So we found them at that trade show. And then I think a year later, soon after Dragon's Den, they were like, okay, yeah, let's test you in just one region. So they tested us initially just in Southern California. I think we were in like 13 doors or something to begin with, which was actually a great way to launch. It was frustrating at that time, because a lot of entrepreneurs are chomping at the bit. They want to launch into all 600 or 500 stores from day one, but it was really smart of the buyer to launch us in this way. They were able to prove out the products in that small region. It was also a lot easier for us to support as a brand, like 13 stores from like an inventory logistics standpoint, from a like field rep marketing standpoint. It just gets so difficult when you do this huge mega launches out of the gates. So that went well. And then I think that buyer introduced us to the Northern California buyers. So then we were across California. And then soon after that, we were introduced to the Canadian buyer. We launched across Canada, which is just Ontario and BC, that Whole Foods has locations. And then I think it was around a year and a half ago that we launched nationwide across the US in every Whole Foods store location. So that was over the course of, I think, like 3 years, basically.
So for those founders out there that are thinking about retail as a growth strategy or a bolt-on to their online business, let's say, what, looking back, would you have done differently, if anything, to get into retail? And what advice could you share with those founders that are thinking about retail more broadly?
Yeah, great question. I would say get started with the mom and pops. Learn the language of the industry. Understand what a line sheet is. Understand how they like to sample product. Start with these smaller local accounts that you can go and meet in person, and you can understand what works well at shelf and what doesn't. Maybe your packaging actually needs to change in order for you to succeed at retail. Maybe your price point needs to change. Maybe it needs to go up for the types of retailers that you're launching into, which was something that we learned as well. We were actually priced, I think, too cheap initially, that people didn't associate the product as being high quality. Learn the ropes of these smaller accounts before you start going for the larger multinationals. Once you do start having conversations with multinationals, there's no one way to get introduced to them. You have to go to the trade shows. You have to like network on LinkedIn, ask for intros from other people, even if it's not your category buyer. We've gotten into retailers all of these different ways. There's no one path, unfortunately. And then once you do land a large retail account, do not do a nationwide launch. Even if they're saying, let's do this nationwide, you should push back and ask for a smaller set of doors so that you can learn the ropes, your operational team can understand what's needed to support those accounts, and you can also not throw millions of dollars worth of inventory without knowing if you're actually going to be able to move it off the shelf.
I was going to say there must be a huge impact to cash flow.
Huge impact.
And or capital requirements to go national.
It's a huge amount of cash flow that you're having to outlay. And a lot of these retailers will have net 60, net 90 day terms is what they'll ask for initially. And so that's another consideration that founders need to make.
So when you and Connie are thinking about raising capital, which you have done, and we'll dive into this now, but was this a result of simply the direction of the brand going into retail and then wanting to expand into more retailers beyond Whole Foods and the capital that would be required to do that? Is that what led you guys to seek funds?
That was a huge part of it. That was what led to our first like larger round. So we did a friends and family round, which was like really small, like $130,000. That was basically just to fund the rebrand and to like fund the initial packaging that we needed, the creative work, the new website, new photography, all of that. And then soon after Dragon's Den, we raised, I think it was 1.3 or 1.4 million in 2 weeks. And that was because we had all this momentum. We had Dragon's Den, we had commits from large retailers. And it was like a night and day difference of raising that money versus the $130,000 it took us forever to raise from a few small angels. And Connie's parents ended up putting in like half the round, which is why it's now pretty much a friends and family round. But yeah, that was why we needed the money, was to support these nationwide launches. And then also when we looked at the successful brands that got really large in our space that eventually got acquired, almost all of them had raised capital at some point. And so we knew that this was going to be an inevitability for us, is that we needed to raise external money.
Okay, so that first big raise, 1.2 million?
1.3, 1.4, okay. Somewhere around there.
Did that come from one venture partner?
No, it was a bunch of like super angels. So people that were putting in $50,000 to $100,000, but it was all angels. So I think we had like maybe 20 to 25 people in that round.
Was there a lead investor that facilitated all this? You're just pitching one-to-one?
Pitching one-to-one and finding connections. So we would be on calls with these investors from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. I actually slept over at Connie's house so that we could maximize our time. And we just had meetings like scheduled back to back to back with people. Every time that someone would say no, we would ask for an intro to somebody else that might be interested, Or if they said yes, we would also ask for an intro to somebody else in their network that might be interested. And we set the terms. So we raised on a safe, we set the valuation, we set the minimum check size. And we also set a really, really firm close date, which is something that I think we screwed up in those, that first round that we had tried to raise, is that we were like, oh, we'll just do a rolling close and we won't set a firm close date. No, I think founders really need to set a close date to light some sort of urgency mm-hmm. underneath investors. Otherwise, the tendency is just like, oh, you're a bit early, but let's keep in touch. Or, oh, not right now. You're a bit too small, but we love what you're doing. Let's keep in touch. You need to give some sort of sense of FOMO. Investors mm-hmm. are very emotionally driven compared to what a lot of what you would think.
That sounds exhausting. I mean, you hear from companies that raise that raising becomes a full-time job for the founders, right? Yeah. You're pitching constantly. You've got to be out there, you know, pounding and pitching and selling all the time. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like all good things, because 1.2 million in 2 weeks is pretty quick.
It was really fast.
You raised 1.3 million and you've now raised how much to date?
We've raised a total of 6 million to date. So there was that first like $1.3 million round. And then around 18 months later, we did another 1.3 million. That one took us like 5 or 6 months to raise. It was a much harder environment to fundraise in. And it was like pulling teeth to get that money over the finish line. And then around a year ago, in Q1 of last year, we raised 3.5 million. And that was our first time that we actually had venture in, like formal equity, more venture equity. And it was our first time doing a priced round. All the rest of them were done on safes. So that was our first time also adding a new board member that wasn't just Connie and I.
When we were talking earlier, you were mentioning to me that the right investor goes way beyond the size of the check, right? And it's all about the vision that the investor has for the brand or how they would work with the company. Tell me more.
You want to make sure that whatever investors you bring on have the same vision for the company as you do, or at the very least won't interfere and are supportive of the vision that you have. And it's pretty obvious, actually, about which investors won't work. I think a lot of founders think that they're like wolf in sheep's clothing and they'll like sneak in. And maybe there's some cases where that happens, but oftentimes investors will tell you like, this is a deal I'm looking for. And if you're like, that's never going to be us, that's probably a good signal that they're not the right ones for you. Or you'll get this gut feeling that you're like, I don't know that I can really trust this person. I would say founders should listen to those gut feelings. So one example of this is one of an investor who's wanting to put in like a sizable check. I think it was like $200,000 in that first round. We ended up turning away because his whole vision is that he wanted to find like the next Estee Lauder. And that was not the vision that Connie and I have for the business. We don't want to build a massive multinational company with thousands of employees, like global offices, IPOing. That was not the vision that we had for the business that we wanted to start. And so it was just such a mismatch. And that would not have been a relationship that would have worked out.
Sounds like this principle also applies to your retail partners.
Yeah.
Right? Because you guys are still in Whole Foods, as far as I understand it, but not in Target. But at one point, you were in Target?
We were in Target for a very short blip, like 6 months. And we launched there, I think it was the start of 2021, I want to say. So very soon, actually, after we launched at Whole Foods. But we made the mistake with that one where the buyer wanted to roll us out across 800 doors. We were not ready for it. And we pulled out within 6 months of being at shelf because we could just see the writing on the wall. We were like, our product is not moving. We don't have nearly enough brand recognition within the US to support a rollout of this size. And also our products are probably too premium for Target. There's no opportunity for us to educate at shelf of how are 3Ships products different from this product that's $8.99. Is the Target consumer necessarily going to care? So what we learned through that was that it's much better for us to be the more affordable price point at a more premium prestige retailer than to be the more premium product at a mass retailer. And that doing that slow rollout would have been so much better for us. But I'm very glad that we pulled out because controlling your destiny and controlling the narrative, especially within retail, is really, really, really important. So
who's next? Who's the next big retailer?
We would love to land one of the big beauty retailers. So Shoppers, Sephora, Ulta, any of those would be the next step for us. And I think that we're starting to get to a point in Canada that we'd be ready for that.
Take note, we're in Canada, SDM. So if you're watching or listening, 3Ships is going in, whether you like it or not. Okay, so talk to me about the responsibility the company has beyond the fundraise. So from an investor standpoint, are they directing where your capital is going to be allocated and or used? Do they care? How do you think about capital allocation beyond the fundraise?
For our investors, they're not very hands-on with those details. They have to approve our annual budgets. And so that's their process of making sure that they're aligned with where we're spending the money. But they're not checking every single like transfer that goes out of the business. They're not being like, oh, you spent $20,000 on this campaign. Like, we don't agree with that. They're not involved in those day-to-day details. Most investors care about the high level. And as long as you communicate with them about both the good and the bad, and you communicate with them proactively, they're not going to feel the need to be in the weeds of your business. Like, that's ultimately not really how most investors see their role. They're more there to support you and to help guide you and allow you to see around the next corner and make sure that you're well capitalized for the growth that you have. They don't typically want to be in the details, from my experience. The only time that they'll start to come into the details is if you're not proactively sharing with them. So something that we've always done from the very first round is that we would send out quarterly investor updates to all of our investors. And in those early stages, even prospective investors, to keep those leads warm before our next round. So we'd share with them what's working for us, what some of our major wins were, where we can use help, what intros we need and connections we need, and then what some of our major projects are for the next quarter. It would probably take us like 20 minutes to draft this email and send it out through Klaviyo just to a list of investors in there. Pays off so well because then they feel like they actually know what's going on. They won't be on top of you because you're proactively communicating. And also you're probably going to get more out of them because you're asking constantly every quarter for something new. So you're always front of mind for them of being like, okay, I know what Three Ships is up to, or I know what they're struggling with. So when I meet someone in my network, that's someone that I can introduce Three Ships to. Yeah.
Speaking of Klaviyo, lots of folks that are watching will be familiar with Klaviyo and or are thinking about using the platform or using it with the marriage with Shopify on the front end. How do you think about email strategy on the whole? What's worked? What hasn't worked? How many emails do you have? Are you using email to build community? Just expand on this for me.
Yes, yes, yes. Email is such an underrated channel. I think for us, it accounts for around 35% of our revenue, give or take, between email and SMS, 30 to 35%. It's incredible. It is a way to keep engaged with your customers. One of the formats that works the best for us is actually like long form, like more written content of like founder notes, so that people feel really, really connected to what's going on with the business, especially if there's a major change. Like if we have to take a price increase, we'll write that out as a founder note. We won't just do like, oh, our prices are going up, like shop now. It'll be a longer form explaining what's going on. Or if we're launching a new campaign that's really emotional and like really means something on a personal level to Connie and I, we'll write that out in a longer form note. So that's an underrated piece of creative that brands should be leaning into. And email is huge. Like at any opportunity, you should be collecting emails, trying to get people to stay on the email list. I think our list right now is around 150,000 like engaged subscribers. So it's a great way to keep people coming back.
How does Three Ships think about community? I know that community is sort of a buzzy term these days. A lot of brands thinking about building community as kind of one cornerstone or pillar of their brand strategy. Do you have a community strategy specifically? Do you think about it in sort of like detailed elements as to how you're going to address it?
We do. I wouldn't say that's a full community strategy, but it's making sure that we bring our customers along for the journey every way that we possibly can. So having direct conversations with them on social. Connie and I are in a lot of our content. We go on social to ask them questions, even to help them rename products. We've gone on there to help ideate with our customers. We even involve them in our actual development process. So we'll send out directly from the lab, 50 samples to 50 customers have said, yes, I want to test your products before they come to market. And they'll give us feedback that will allow us to go back to the lab and iterate until we get the perfect formula. So I think bringing them behind the scenes is a big aspect of community and taking them along for the journey with you. We also do live shopping events, which I think are also very underrated. We've probably all heard of how much live shopping is crushing it in China. We've seen those videos of people that hold up like the item for 2 seconds and slide the orange boxes away. But live shopping is a great way to build community in North America too. So it'll be very simple. We use this platform called Firework. Connie and I will get on in front of an iPhone for basically an hour and talk about the new product, converse with the customers back and forth. They can ask us questions. We ask where they're calling in from. We'll usually have maybe 1,000 people join in for during that 1 hour period, and we'll do $35,000 to $40,000 in sales in that 1 hour. So it's a great channel for community building.
Mm-hmm. Other channels that have been effective from a return on ad spend perspective, what can you share?
We're still very heavy into Meta. That's where the vast majority of our media spend goes. Yeah, still. And we find that that still gets us the best return on ad spend, best click-through rates. Yeah, we're still big into Meta.
TikTok?
No, we haven't really broached TikTok too much. It's a very different form of content. Mm-hmm. And being a Canadian company, TikTok Shop is not available to Canadian companies. We've tried every way we possibly could to try to get set up on there. Unfortunately, it's not available in Canada yet, but TikTok should roll out to Canada. We would love to be on there.
Do you feel like you need to hedge against Meta? I mean, it feels like Meta has been so the default from a customer acquisition and media spend standpoint for quite some time.
It has, yeah.
Over a decade now, a pseudo monopoly on the D2C media acquisition space. Do you see some sort of platform evolution happening? Do you think there are other strategies or tactics that companies should be looking at or taking advantage of?
I mean, they should always be focusing on customer retention first and making sure that they don't have a leaky bucket within their funnel. So those strategies will never go away. I don't think of email, SMS. SMS is very underrated, and that's more of a new form of marketing. But for us, for the foreseeable future, we've tried other platforms. We've tried YouTube, and we don't really see the same lift in the same way. TikTok is not available. In Canada, we've done a few smaller tests just within the ads platform, but that's not really how TikTok operates in the same way. It's more about virality and getting creators posted, which they want TikTok Shop in order to be able to post and get their compensation through affiliate codes like really easily. So until I think TikTok will be the next big thing for us once they come to Canada.
How do you and Connie think about influencers and or the role of influencers with 3Ships, if there is one?
We've tried influencer marketing in the past where you're paying for posts, you're seeding. Seeding works very well because it's authentic. It's a strong relationship.
Sorry, what is seeding for listeners or viewers that don't know?
So seeding is where you'll send out your product to an influencer or a content creator with no expectations. They can post about it if they like the product, or they don't have to post about it, but you're not paying anything. You're just giving them free product. That works very well because it's authentic. People will post about the product if they really love it. Once they post, we'll then set them up with an affiliate code for them to start earning commissions. Anything that we've done of just paying for posts has never worked. Like, we've wasted so much money on influencer postings. I do not believe in it. I don't usually approve budgets for it anymore because it just doesn't work for us as a brand.
How has your relationship with Connie evolved over the years? Feels like within 24 hours, deciding you're going to be business partners. 8 years later, you're best friends and running this thing 24/7. Is it tough?
It is like any sort of major relationship that you have in your life. I think in the initial days, we had to learn a lot about the ways that we are different, especially in our communication styles. For example, if we said that we were going to meet up at 7, Connie would be like sitting there waiting, starting at 7. Even if we were meeting up at her house, like that I was going to come to her house at 7, she would just sit there and wait. She wouldn't like do other things like around her house. She'd just be sitting there. And I didn't know that. Like, whereas for me, I'm just like, okay, if I come at 7:05, that's still fine and on time. That took some adjustment, is just like our different communication styles and expectations. She's someone that will add 3 exclamation marks to everything that she types and sends because she doesn't want anyone to think that like she's upset, and will have so many smiley faces. If someone's like, see you at 7, she would put like 3 exclamation marks. And then I would just reply back, sounds good. No emoji or exclamation marks. And she would think that I was pissed at her. Uh-huh. So those sorts of little intricacies of communication took us, I would probably say, like 1 to 2 years for us to really understand and work through. But it's the same as any sort of relationship that you're in, right? And Connie and I, in many ways, like, we're more accountable to each other and signed up for more legal requirements than we are with our husbands. Like, I'm accountable to more debt with Connie through all of our lines of credit that we fund inventory through than I am to my husband on our mortgage. It's like any relationship. I think you really need to focus on quality time together. We really intentionally carve that out of having time to just go and be friends. We try not to talk about the business, even though it inevitably always comes up. And then we also have designated sessions put aside where we'll actually give feedback to each other. We try not to let things fester. And so once a month, we basically give each other mini performance reviews of like two things that person did well in the month before and one thing that they didn't do well or could improve on. That's helped tremendously with open communication, is having that specific time set aside that we both have to feedback to each other. So it's a learning process to learn what works for you.
Even before you launched, you had it in your mind that you wanted a co-founder.
Yeah.
Why do you think you would be successful running this alone, or you wouldn't be? Or?
I don't think so. I don't think either of us would be able to run this business alone. We have too many gaps as our own individuals that the other person helps to round out. And I think being a solo founder, I have so much respect for those people that can do it. I definitely can't. I find it very lonely, very isolating. The lows feel so much lower because you don't have someone to commiserate with that really understands. And then the highs don't feel as sweet because you don't have somebody that understands what it took to get to that point. So for me, it was a very obvious decision. And when I went through that process of deciding, okay, yeah, I want to bring on a co-founder, a lot of it was reflecting on my time in school of like, okay, did I work better on my own as solo projects, or did I like group projects more? I loved group projects. I created better work. I was more happy with the output. The process seemed less stressful. I didn't like individual projects at all. It felt very lonely and boring and hard. So I think that any entrepreneur that's maybe making that decision of should I have a co-founder, should I not, do some reflection of, do you prefer group projects or do you prefer working solo? Would you like to have somebody that you're accountable to and that they're accountable to you as well? And it's a very personal decision, but it was definitely the right one for Connie and I. And also doing 50-50, I think, is really important. Like the business, it was not a business when I met Connie. It was an idea. And a lot of people at that time told me, oh, why would you go 50-50? Why didn't you do 60-40? It was your idea. I'm like, well, an idea is a dime a dozen. Like, it really comes down to the execution. The idea is like 1% of it. Execution is 99% of building a successful company. And I didn't want to just have an expensive employee. Like, I wanted her to feel like she was truly in the weeds with me, and for us to not have one person that has ultimate veto power. Like, I didn't need that power over her. I wanted a true partner in the company.
How do you and Connie navigate personal challenges that come up? I know you're talking offline, if you're comfortable sharing, you had a big personal challenge happen, totally unforeseen, just 2 years into the business.
Yeah. So for some background, in November 2019, I was 26. Connie and I were the only two employees with the business. We had just started the rebrand. Rebrand was like 6 months away, 7 months away from relaunching, and I was diagnosed with brain cancer. It was not on my bingo card, did not expect to be dealt a blow like that at such a young age. It was very destabilizing, to say the least. I went in for surgery 4 months later in March of 2020, right before COVID, before I was discharged. Like, I think I was discharged 2 days before the lockdowns happened here in Toronto. And so it was a period of time of a lot of confrontation of some of our biggest fears as humans. Like, you have to come to terms during a diagnosis like that, that we're not in control, which can be very scary or it can be very freeing. And I found that during that period, Three Ships was a real source of creative inspiration for me. It was like an outlet. It gave me something to look forward to. I don't think it ever occurred to either of us that we would throw in the towel and be like, oh, we're still early in this company. Yes, we're full-time with it, but like, we can still go back and get jobs. Like, let's just do that. This is too many risks. Never occurred to us. Because I just imagine myself being told that I have 2 years left to live. And if I hadn't pursued this, and if I hadn't decided to build this business, I would have regretted it. I would have died regretting it. And I just didn't want that for myself or for people around me. And it's also taught me a lot about how to be a good, grounded founder. It makes you realize when you face something that's truly a life-changing situation, that there's very little that can happen in the business that is honestly that big of a deal. A lot of it is more like challenges and hurdles and inconveniences, but very few things are truly make or break that can happen in a company. So it's allowed me to be much more focused on what really matters, focus on the impact that we want to have for our customers. It's giving me a lot more belief in what we're doing of natural products and the role that that serves in people's lives. And it's in many ways brought Connie and I closer together, because she also had to confront these fears of losing like a best friend and her co-founder. we had to have those hard conversations of what happens if I don't wake up from the surgery. It was a 10-hour operation. Like, they were going deep into my brain to try to remove this tumor. And they take you through all of those risks of there's a 2% chance that you won't wake up from this, or there's a 5% chance you'll have a stroke on the operating table and you won't be able to speak when you wake up again. There's a 8% chance that you won't be able to walk. My tumor was the size of a large egg right next to my motor strip. And so the main area that they were worried about was lack of, like, that I would be paralyzed on my left leg after waking up. I did have some issues, had to relearn how to walk, had to relearn how to, like, read and tell time. Like, my perception of things and how they relate to each other was all thrown off from the surgery. But all that came back within a couple of weeks. I was very lucky. But we had to have those really hard conversations of the uncomfortable what ifs. And again, I think that that was for the better for us as founders, because it taught us that those are things you can't avoid. You have to confront those conversations head on, and anything can happen within life. It's obviously been a very scary process to go through, and I'm still getting treatment now. I'm on a clinical trial at Princess Margaret. It's been hard to juggle a major, like, chronic health problem as a new founder, but it's also been incredibly rewarding.
It's incredibly rewarding to hear the story. So thank you for sharing. Do you feel a different connection to what you're building?
Oh, 100%.
Now having gone through this?
Yeah, night and day. Okay. Like, this really feels like it serves a greater purpose for people. And I have an understanding of more and more about why our customers that are like us, that care about natural products, the deep connection that they have, that they're doing this not because they necessarily want to change how their skin looks, or they want to look like 20 years younger. Like, that's not their expectation here, but they want to take care of themselves for the long term. And so it feels like a very positive, uplifting type of way that we can deliver that for people, and to give them that sense of peace and comfort and control over what it is that they're using on their bodies every single day. And it's also given me a greater appreciation of the ups and downs that go along the way. Cause I'm like, wow, we're so lucky to experience these challenges. We're so lucky to get to do all of these different things. Like, it's not lost on me that a lot of people don't get to experience that. And I now view aging especially as truly a gift. Like, I don't like hearing people tell young people, you don't want to get old. Like, yes, we do. That's a goal for all of us. We all want to live long, healthy, happy lives. We all want to get old. I don't understand where this narrative about anti-aging and being scared of aging came from. It's so negative and backwards and just false.
I agree.
Yeah. And I, especially in the beauty industry, that's so predatory on people, of making them fear aging or looking their age or getting older. It's just wrong. And so something that we stand for as a brand is, you will never, ever hear us use the terms anti-aging unless Connie and I slip up when we're talking, because it's so embedded into the narrative of the language that we use. You won't find it anywhere on our website. We don't market any of our products as anti-aging. We'll talk about the benefits it'll give for your skin, that will be smoothing or firming, but we won't talk about anti-aging, because to my core, I believe that it's such a gift that people should not be shamed for or scared of. Like, we should all want to get old and look forward to that process of getting older.
You know, I'll ask you, we're both founders, so I think that this is an important question to ask, but do you think that as founders, as entrepreneurs, that we're doing a good enough job talking about health and wellness?
I don't think so.
Founders?
I don't think so. Burnout is so prevalent. I've known founders that have burnt out and had to leave their businesses. I think the expectation is that you need to build something really fast. The stories that get talked about are the quick builds that then go from being launched to acquired within 3 years. And that's just not realistic. That's not the path for most companies. And so sustainable growth for both the business and the founder just doesn't get talked about enough. And Connie and I have definitely fallen victim to this at certain points too. Like, I used to make fun of Connie for, she'd be like, oh, I had self-care last night. I had a bath. I was like, did you have your laptop in the bath with you doing emails? And she's like, yes, but I was still relaxing. I'm like, Connie, like, you need to fully unplug. And so I think it's really important for you as a founder to listen to your body and to recognize when you're feeling stressed and overwhelmed, when you're feeling burnt out, when you're feeling exhausted. And don't feel guilty to, like, cancel your meetings that afternoon. It's okay. It's not the end of the world. If you're like, I'm so tired, I literally like I'm just viewing all this in a negative light. I don't want to do this right now. It's okay to take a breather for a few hours. Like that's healthy and that's fine. And on the flip side, if you're feeling really inspired and fired up and motivated and your head is in the game that day, work for 12 hours. If that's what you're feeling that you need to do and what you're excited to do. Like I think intuitive work is something that is so underappreciated and under talked about and is so critical for founders to really bring their full selves to their businesses.
I think that's a great place to wrap.
Yeah.
Laura, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Drop us a comment and feedback right below. Tell us what you thought of today's episode. Make sure you're subscribed and we'll see you at the next episode of Shopify Masters.